Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome in to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our regular opportunity to get together as blind or partially sighted people to explore the world of technology. What's accessible, what's inaccessible, and what's somewhere in between. Tech Talk, of course, it's your show. We're always delighted to hear from you, whether you have a comment, a question, a correction, whatever it may be, you can drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K @rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be taking a look at accessible power banks, learning about Braille support on Android, and hearing another accessible video game review from our very own Sightless Combat. So stick around, it's another Tech Talk. A very warm welcome in to our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Hubert Pavalkovich. Good to have you both here. Just before I come to each of you and find out what's on your radar this week, I just need to correct something that you might have heard in last week's programme. I think we incorrectly stated that the RNIB Communi player does not have Bluetooth. In fact, it does have Bluetooth. And thank you very much to those of you who've contacted us to put that right. Always happy to correct any misinformation. So, do get in touch if you hear something that you think we might have got wrong. All right, then. Let's go to you chaps. Callum, first of all, you've got some software updates for us.
Yeah, a couple of big software updates going on this week. So there's an update to the VictorReader Stream 3rd generation that adds the long-awaited Audible support. So this was something that when the Stream 3 was first released, because of I'm not going to get into the technical details, but because of a new protocol that was being used by Humanware, there was no Audible support. It was very difficult, if not impossible, to get your audiobooks onto that device from Audible, but that has now been added, which is a very welcome update. And also these, we've been talking recently about these Zoom recorders, the Zoom H1, H4 and H6 recorders.
The Essential Series, yeah.
The Essential Series, that's it. They've had some software updates as well with accessibility improvements. So there's now a shortcut to toggle on or off the voice guide quickly and easily, rather than having to dig into the settings. And if you've got some of the ones, and if you've got the ones that do multi-track, which I think is the H4 and the H6, the voice guide feature will now read out which tracks you've selected and which tracks you're working on. So a couple of nice little improvements there as well. It's nice to see that these features are evolving.
And I know that Zoom have also tried to make some accessibility improvements to their documentation, although your mileage may vary depending on which software you read those PDFs in. So let us know if you have a Zoom Essential Series recorder, if you've done the update. Let us know how that's going. And if you like Audible on your hardware player, then we'd love to hear how that's going for you. Hubert, you're looking at locks.
Yes, it's an interesting topic, and I've always wondered what people's opinions were on smart locks. So there is one I've recently spotted in an accessibility technology accessibility newsletter, and it's a Yale, spelt Y-A-L-E, so I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a approach.
Yale, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. It's an approach smart lock which unlocks as you approach. It's an interesting one because I'm in two minds about having a technology-based lock. So I wanted to know your opinions on these. I mean, it sounds all cool. You can unlock it when it unlocks when you approach. You can have a one-touch lock button. You have a keypad and custom codes for different visitors, all that. But what's your both chaps' opinion on having a smart lock?
It depends how it works for me. I'm not too sure of the idea of it unlocks as you're approaching. I know when I used to have a guide dog, I would just sometimes, if I weren't going anywhere in particular that day, I'd just have a wander around the estate a couple of times, just wander around the block a bit, and kind of thinking, well, if I walk past my house, does that click the door unlocked without me realizing? You know, if I kind of do a bit, if I'm doing a bit of a circle, you know, go around and come back. But I like the idea of these ones that use the Apple, is it Home Key integration? So you can just walk up to it and kind of tap it, tap your Apple Watch or your iPhone against the lock, and that unlocks it. I like the idea of that. Like, that sounds so cool. Walk up to your front door, tap your watch, and then you're in. And also for deliveries as well, because we've got like a little front porch bit in our house. So there's, you open the first door, there's like a little porch, and then there's a second door to go into the actual house. So, I mean, being able to unlock the door and just ask them to leave a package in the porch and then lock it again afterwards sounds good. But then, I mean, you've always got the fallback of a key, or on most of these, I think you've got the fallback of a physical key. But, I mean, what happens if, you know, oh, I've got all this smart tech, so I'm not going to take the key with me. You get home and then, I don't know, the internet's down or something. It locks out.
That's just it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm a bit undecided. I don't know if I want to rely on tech for something that critical.
Yeah, yeah. Jury's out for me too, I'm afraid. But I know blind people are using smart locks, particularly to open doors remotely, as you say, when there's a delivery, or you know, maybe you've got a visitor or somebody that you trust to kind of enter your property. The proximity thing then, Hubert, is that triggered by your phone, presumably, when you get near it?
This is the thing. It is triggered by your phone's location, which, bearing in mind on that, GPS can sometimes be a bit interesting and says you're approached the house when you're still a bit further away from it, really. I like Callum. I think it's a bit tricky because you can walk past your house and it can unlock the door, really, when it doesn't need to. I think using something like an NFC kind of tag, which then relies closer on the location of your device, so something like you can tap the lock to unlock it, would make more sense. That's the part that I'm a bit skeptical about, really.
But then car users have been using electronic locks for years, right? You know, insert sound of beep, beep, or whatever it is.
Well, that's,
you know,
true, yeah.
Who hasn't heard that in a car park, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, interested to know from you, have you got a smart lock? Would you get a smart lock? Are you where Callum and I are, a little bit jury's out? I don't know. Let us know. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk. All right, guys, keep it locked on. It's Tech Talk. We often talk about the tools and aids and attitudes and skills and knowledge that we as blind and partially sighted people need to get ourselves out and about safely and with confidence. A project that RNIB is leading that hopes to make some impact in this area is Travel Well with Tech. And if you were listening to our coverage of the California State University conference in March, we spoke with Dawn Slater, who is in RNIB's innovation team and leads on Travel Well with Tech. Well, I thought, as we are now in the month of May, I would touch base with Dawn and find out how it's going. Dawn, welcome back into RNIB Connect Radio. For those who didn't catch you last time round, just share with us a little bit about the aims and objectives of Travel Well with Tech.
Thanks, Dave. Pleasure to be speaking to you again. So I'm working as part of our central innovation team. The great thing about this project is it's actually looking at what blind and partially sighted people do really well and trying to make sure that we can cascade that through to people who are maybe a little bit less confident with travelling unaccompanied or making unfamiliar journeys. And so we're hoping to have a really wide-reaching appeal. As you said, our ambition really, as part of the wider Getting Around priority impact area, is to enable more blind and partially sighted people to travel where they want, when they want, and how they want, safely, independently, and spontaneously. So we're really excited to be leading this flagship project for that Getting Around impact area.
Tell us a little bit about the project so far then. What's happened already?
So far, this is the phase one of the new project. So we're funded by Motability. We're developing a really amazing relationship with them. They're extremely interested in investing in new technology to help more people travel more independently. So we've just finished our exciting participant recruitment phase. We actually put a survey out onto all of our Facebook groups and reached out to a number of our networks. And we have 200 amazing participants who have contributed to our survey. So literally, we are just starting to analyse that now. from that survey, the next stage will be to identify those who were interested in participating in some following up stages. So we're looking to select some participants to do some interviews, also some field testing with our researchers, and also some ideation groups. So the really exciting bit will come when we do the field testing. It's kind of a test and learn environment. So we want to look at what currently people use to travel who are confident and confident using tech. We also want to look at what travellers are doing who love to travel but don't currently use any tech to travel. And we want to make sure that we pick up on those who may be a little bit hesitant and who are nervous to travel or use tech to travel.
Right, and it is those people who are perhaps less tech savvy that I'm particularly interested in. You mentioned there your initial 200 respondents to the survey that have been shared online, on social media, but obviously that's not necessarily going to reach those that aren't on social media or online. How do we capture those voices as well?
Great point, Dave. And we were really conscious of this as well. We really wanted to reach all of these different cohorts. And we appreciated that actually that might not be the source to gaining these hesitators through the survey. So we've been working really closely with our partner agency, and we've literally bespoke, we've handpicked participants who we know are hesitant either to travel or to use tech. So we've made sure that we've got a really amazing broad cohort of sample criteria for us to make sure we actually capture all the different elements of both planning and making a journey, and also looking at the physical and the emotional aspects of every time a blind and partially sighted person encounters taking, you know, thinks about taking a brand new journey.
So you've got a couple of hundred people with whom you are conducting research. You're very much in the research phase at the moment. So once you've crunched these numbers and the qualitative responses as well, what's the next step, Dawn?
Once we've got all of this together, we will then lead into our ideation workshops. So that will really be the trigger to lead us into phase two of the project, for which we already have commitment for Motability. That will kick off in September, and that's when it gets really exciting, because we will be looking at exploring solutions.
Is this research just about the technology that blind and partially sighted individuals use and the choices that we make, or are there implications here for mobility and orientation teams, people who work in sensory impairment, rehab, friends, family, colleagues, other stakeholders?
That's a really good question, Dave. Initially, this project is to identify what works well and really understand what nuggets, what parts of what apps, but also understand where the app gaps are. So initially, yes, we're looking at blind and partially sighted people's experience. But of course, in doing that, as I said, this is a flagship project. This is going to act as a springboard for the wider getting around impact area, which is running, you know, we're looking at that for the next 3, 5, 10 years. So absolutely, what we start off in this project will then tangent off into multiple other projects. We already have, I think, 40 other projects on our wish list that will lead off from this project. So absolutely, we're looking for it to reach far and wide, blind and partially sighted people, friends, family, communities, but also touching legislation, policies, every aspect that acts as a barrier to any blind and partially sighted person today. We want to have some impact on overcoming that.
And you are, of course, centering the lived experience, not least of which, of course, you yourself are partially sighted. Would you describe yourself as partially sighted, Dawn?
Yeah.
And how do you travel just now?
I tend to be very lazy and travel by taxi, to be honest.
Well, there you go, if it works and gets you to where you need to be, but often not the most affordable option. So you mentioned that we can expect some exciting stuff in the autumn, and you sort of teased us with solutions. What might some of those be?
We don't want to preempt, because we really want to take the insight from this lived experience. However, we have an idea of where it might go, and that's what's also exciting about the project. So it could lead to something for those hesitators, maybe looking at something to help them manage their anxiety, helping talk them through how to use different bits of tech, and also helping them understand what is available in order to help them plan and make those journeys with a little bit more confidence. We'll be looking at the explorers who don't use tech and understanding Why don't they use tech? Is there something that we can deliver for them that will help expand their opportunities and enable them to go further and faster? And for the explorers with tech, it's really looking at what works well. And so understanding, is there some new tech? We're working really closely with a number of leading universities. We're looking at the AI capabilities and seeing if there's anything we could layer on there that would help to develop their confidence and ability to travel further and more often.
And is this all encompassing? Are you looking at, you know, sort of before you make the journey, planning, and then actually what you might use out on the street or the train or the bus?
Yes, Dave, we're looking at absolutely everything, because literally every journey starts with that first step of deciding to even think about making a journey. So we will be using ethnography studies to look at everything that's done in planning and thinking through the planning stage, committing to a journey, understanding how they can buy a ticket online, planning their route, all the way through to then making that first step out the front door, whether that's to a local shop or to get a bus, a train, a tube, a taxi, really looking at the minutiae, kind of granular detail of each step of each part of the journey in order to get them to their final destination and, of course, get them back home again safely.
And when we think about journeys, often that involves public transport or, as you mentioned, a taxi. I know an increasing area of interest for RNIB has been indoor navigation as well. Is that something that you're going to be looking at?
It's definitely something as an organisation that we're looking at. Within this particular project, we'll be looking at indoor locations such as train stations, that kind of thing. However, we're working in partnership with another RNIB team who are looking more specifically at indoor navigation.
It's often those interfaces, isn't it, between different modes of transport or the final, you know, 10 metres getting to the door. They're often the pain points, I think, for those of us who are blind or partially sighted. You know, once you get on the train or the plane or whatever it is, right, it's all fine at that point, he says. Well, in my experience, mm-hmm. But it's getting, you know, onboarding, getting, you know, whatever the word is, you know, when you're disembarking, there you go, at your destination. What happens at that point when somebody insists that you, you know, perhaps get in a buggy that you don't necessarily want to get into, or that you take a route that you know you don't necessarily want to take? So I guess that's going to be a big area of focus for you as well.
You know what, Dave, you're absolutely right. It is those kind of bits in the middle, and we're calling them the glue or the bridges that really hold that journey together. And they're often the ones that you can't plan down to finite detail. You can plan so much, but they're the ones where potentially there may not be any assistance around. There may be diversions. It may be a split between two different providers. So it's that kind of space in the middle that no one really owns, but we still have to navigate. So for sure, that's going to be built into all of our journey modelling. So we really try and do some robust testing of where we could improve those areas of the journey.
I went on a journey recently where I'd bought my tickets on an app, and I was expecting the tickets to appear as, you know, an e-ticket that I could then show to the train manager or revenue protection or whatever, you know, during the journey. But because my journey involved using the London Underground, the app decided that I needed a physical ticket to collect at the railway station. I got to the railway station. There was nobody at the ticket office, and the expectation was that I would collect my ticket from an inaccessible ticket machine. What can we do about that sort of thing, Dawn?
It's a great point, Dave. And today I don't have the solution. This is exactly why we're doing this research. We're doing this test and learn research, and a number of our journeys will be encountering exactly the scenario you've just described. And we'll be looking at what currently is used as a workaround for them and seeing if there's anything we can bring in from a tech perspective and also from a training and education perspective for the transport organisations that will take that stress and anxiety away from a blind and partially sighted traveller in the future.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there is a lot of stress and anxiety around travelling. I know plenty of blind people that, you know, quite honestly, unless somebody goes with them, they would just rather not go out.
You're right, Dave, and that's really what I'd like to kind of gather from those hesitators. That's why we really want to find bespoke these participants to make sure we get the right people who are in exactly that position to understand, is there anything that we can help and support or provide that will give them more confidence to step out of the door? And again, it's a personal journey. It may be that somebody just wants to go three doors down for a coffee with their neighbour. And it also might mean that somebody wants to, you know, travel to Australia by themselves. So it's really looking at individual journeys and looking at where each start point is, because the end point isn't always the same for everybody.
That's very true. All right, Dawn, well, look, good luck with the project. We wish you well, and we're very keen to hear about progress as and when that happens. What's the best way for listeners to stay in touch with Travel Well with Tech?
I think, as we've said, Dave, I'm happy to do a monthly update with you so that they can stay on board, so to speak, excuse the pun. But yeah, I'd love to chat with you once a month and let you know where we're up to and what's going on.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to hold you to that, Dawn. So do stay in touch and do let us know what you find as you find it. And we will try and speak with you next month.
Thanks, Dave. Been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Dawn Slater there with RNIB's Travel Well with Tech project. Thanks so much, Dawn, for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Today, we are here to talk about As Dusk Falls, a game that is accessible to play. But just how much? Well, once again, RNIB's Accessible Gaming Officer, Sightloss Combat, joins me to tell me all about it. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Hopefully you are likewise. Thank you for having me back. Really good to be here.
Yes, I'm looking forward to this. I've not really heard much about As Dusk Falls. There are other people that might be in the same position. Can you tell us what As Dusk Falls is?
So As Dusk Falls is a gripping, decade-spanning crime drama. And admittedly, that wouldn't normally be my sort of game. That was before I played it. And I very much enjoyed going through the experiences. It is a very... what I loosely term as a heavy game. It's very dark. It deals with some very mature themes. So viewer discretion and player discretion is advised. But yeah, it's a fully accessible story of various characters who go through a rather, you know, what can be at times a tense, you know, sort of very much down to earth kind of grounded story. But it's a fantastic game. I played it when it launched, but we'll come onto that in a second. But if you haven't checked it out, it's on multiple platforms as well.
Yes, we'll go into platforms and availability later on. Let's move on to the accessibility of this game. So again, there has been an update to improve accessibility even more so, but let's talk about the general accessibility level of the game.
So before the recent patch that was released by Interior Night and its PlayStation 5 version that came alongside it, the accessibility of the game was actually really high as a bar anyway. So the only thing that was missing was actually audio description, I think, was the main thing that was missing, and maybe a few adjustments to what was narrated in terms of the menus. But other than that, you know, it was fully playable start to finish. I actually reviewed it when it came out. I put a video out when it released or just before it released, and played through the entire thing without any assistance being needed. So even before this recent patch, it was, you know, pretty much fully playable. There were just puzzle pieces that were missing, shall we say.
So let's go on to the most recent update then. Has it filled in these missing accessibility puzzle pieces? What has the new update introduced?
So the short answer is yes, it has resolved a lot of those puzzle piece, you know, intricacies. The key thing to note is the PlayStation 5 version has DualSense support. So the wonderful haptics of the DualSense controller are used to arguably full effect on PS5, but of course, you know, other platforms that support controllers do include you know, haptics as well. The big thing really, or the even bigger thing, is really audio description. So the fact that the game now will describe natively what's going on in these cutscenes and in the QuickTime events and things as well, you know, where it can, It's all been put together in conjunction with the wonderful people at Descriptive Video Works, who are also known for their work on titles like Spider-Man 2, just to name a recent example of what they've been up to. And the interesting thing about it is it uses the system voice of the platform you're working with. So whether that's PlayStation 5, whether that's Xbox, whether that's PC, in terms of the versions I've tried, which are the Xbox and PS5 versions, they both use the console's, system voice. So you're, and that's the same for the menus as well. So you're getting a consistent experience regardless of, what you're playing on, because it all uses the same setup. And you can even adjust the speed of the speech as well. Those of you that are into that will be pleased to know that that is an adjustable option as well. Very much to the enjoyment of me and other viewers who are similarly inclined to immediately turn up the rate of speech so that it sounds less tedious and more comprehensible at during these intense sequences that happen as part of the game.
From your experience of playing it, what do you think of the game in general and the accessibility when you yourself played it?
So I've actually not finished the game under its new patch because I've been playing through in a multiplayer setting, of all things, with the wonderful May from Interior Night, one of the developers of the game. And in all honesty, I've had so much, I've got so much more out of it than I would otherwise before the audio description was in there. And this is a prime example of how AD can make a game. It can fill in those gaps that, were previously, that previously existed. So for instance, in the very opening of the game, there is a choice you have to make. So it is all choice driven as well. This entire experience is all choice and QTE driven. So you're not walking around in 3D environments. You are, you essentially exist in a void, making choices and, completing these quick time events as you go through. There is a choice very early on where the information provided visually is key to, what you then choose. And previously that choice was not audio described, but with the AD, you then know exactly what the visual information is. So it provides that parity that sighted players then, are getting the same information as you are, as opposed to a greater degree of information. So I think the only issue I had was a few menu prompts that either weren't reading when they should, or, weren't reading correctly, things like that. And the choice tree being quite difficult to understand afterwards. But other than that, the actual core narrative has been fantastic to work through, particularly when May and I realized that it was actually quite fun to work as a team and try and figure out what choice we were going to make together as a duo, and working through the logic, the reasoning, the, the narrative strings that were holding this all together. So it's been a fantastic experience to go back through a game that I haven't played in a very long time because of this update coming at least a year and, a year and change after launch, which is relatively unheard of. It's brilliant to see companies factoring that into games that haven't, had any patches for a long time.
Based on what we've heard, would you agree that this game has reached a level of full playability thanks to its accessibility?
I would say so, other than, of course, the slight issues with prompts and things in the menu system. I would say it's, fully playable. It's definitely worth going out and getting to support the devs, if nothing else. And I'm really pleased to, be able to see this game reach the potential that I hoped it would have at launch. I was saying at launch, AD is the one thing that could really help this game, become as accessible as it can be. And then, lo and behold, a while later, AD gets added. So I was very, very excited to see that. I was like, oh, cool, they're adding it now. That was, it was out of nowhere that it happened. So I would say if you want something different, if you want something that isn't just, necessarily reaction-based, that might need guides, etc. as well, you should go out and check out As Dusk Falls for at least an experience that, you won't forget anytime soon, because it's not only different, but it does work with these darker, kind of heavier themes as well. So if you want something, in that realm too, I'd highly suggest checking it out.
And if people would like to check it out, where can they get it?
You can find As Dusk Falls on PlayStation, on Steam, and on Xbox as well. I know there may be other versions floating around too, but I would suggest just typing As Dusk Falls into your search engine of choice, looking at Interior Knights' website and seeing what information you can find there. Though, personally, I would honestly encourage you to look at the PS5 version if you have access to that console, because the DualSense haptics have been very finely crafted, I think is the way I would refer to it. And they definitely enhance that experience that you would get in other places as well.
If people would like to find out more about accessible gaming or even get back into gaming with an accessible twist, where can they go?
So if you want to discuss any of my experiences that I've had or get suggestions from me directly, you can find me on my socials, which are, you know, Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, etc., as Sightless Combat, SightlessKombat. But of course, if you want to find out what RNIB is doing in the gaming space and send queries that way, you can email gaming@rnib.org.uk, or even go to the RNIB's Design for Every Gamer page at rnib.in/designforeverygamer, and maybe even sign up for the player panel if you're interested in that aspect of things too. All the information is on that page.
Fantastic. As always, Sightless Combat, RNIB's accessible gaming officer, thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Now, long-time listeners to Tech Talk may recognise the voice of Steve Nutt. Steve runs his own business, Computerium Services, offering products and services to blind and partially sighted people across the UK. Steve is also known for being a bit of a fan of Android, and we've been talking a little bit recently on Tech Talk about Braille support on Android, and we thought we'd invite Steve along to help us get a bit of a deeper understanding of what that experience is like. Welcome in, Steve. Good to have you back on RNIB Connect Radio. Let's just start at the beginning. Android has had Braille support for a while, but it is now built in to TalkBack, which is the screen reader that you find on most Android smartphones.
Indeed, yes. They used to have a separate app called BrailleBack, and now they've built it all into TalkBack, so you don't have to install anything. It comes as part of the operating system, just as it does with iOS, which is really good. I used to complain a bit when it was a separate app because people had to know how to download from the Play Store and all of that, but now they don't. It all comes installed, and you can actually turn on Braille at setup if you want to.
Excellent. Okay, and we'll talk a bit more about which devices and all of that in a second. The other area where Android offers Braille support is Braille screen input as well.
Yes, it does. It has two modes. It has a what they call tabletop mode, and it has screen away mode. And hold it in your hand with the screen facing away from you, and then you can put your fingers on the keys and on the screen, line them up, and then do Braille input. I use screen away mode sometimes. And then tabletop mode is obviously where you just put it flat on the table, and then you can Braille directly onto the screen. Probably similar to iOS. I'm not sure, though, but I'm not really that familiar with iOS Braille input.
Yeah, quite similar. And I have had really positive experiences actually using Braille screen input on the Pixel, particularly for entering things like PIN codes and stuff like that. You know, it can sometimes be a little bit fiddly trying to find, you know, the buttons on screen. And of course, the beauty of Braille screen input is that the Braille kind of comes to your fingers, and then you're able to confidently write on screen. So we've got support for Braille displays and Braille screen input. So let's focus on those Braille displays. Is it just Bluetooth, or can you connect Braille displays via USB as well?
Bluetooth and USB, yep.
Okay, and do you know which displays are supported?
So it certainly, I know because I use it, it supports the Vizio Braille displays, Vario Ultra 20 and 40. It supports the I think the only Braille displays it doesn't support currently is the HumanWare ones, because they use HID over Bluetooth. So it does support HumanWare over USB, but not over Bluetooth. But that's coming in Android 15, folks. That's official.
Excellent. Well, we're excited about that. I think you can also use the Orbit Reader as well with Android. I've done that.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, and there'll be a list somewhere, I imagine, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And also, if you go into TalkBack's Braille settings, you can see a list of all the displays when it's doing a search and things like that. So you can actually see it on the phone.
All right. So just sort of talk us through then, if somebody has a Braille display and they want to use it with their Android phone, what things do we need to be aware of?
Not a lot, really. I mean, even the Bluetooth pairing mode is done directly within BrailleBack. So you don't have to, in TalkBack, sorry. So you don't have to go into the system, into Bluetooth, and pair your device first and then go into Braille and all that nonsense. Now, used to have to do that with BrailleBack, but no longer. So what you do is you go into BrailleBack and you tick a box that says turn on Braille display usage or use, and you tick that box, and then it starts looking for displays. And so long as your Braille display has Bluetooth turned on, it'll find your display and give you a pair button, and you tap on pair. And if your Braille display's got a pin code, you'll be asked for the pin code, and off you go. And you are then paired, and you start getting Braille immediately. And then inside the Braille settings, because Android's really been good at this. In fact, I think they've been better than iOS in that way, in the sense of gestures and things like that, where Android has tutorials for the gestures. They don't just have practice gestures and things like that. They have actual tutorials on how to use them and things like that. And they check that you're using the gesture in the right way, which is really good. So you go into Braille commands, and then you can learn all the commands on your display. So they're all there listed. And then you go into Braille languages and translations. So you can set it to contracted or uncontracted, UEB, grade 2 non-UEB if you want. You can do pre-UEB and stuff like that. It's got very similar commands to iOS. For example, space with dots 1, 2, 4, 5 will uncontract and contract and things like that.
That's a Braille letter G. So is that's going to work? So you're getting Braille output, obviously. The pins on your Braille display are going up and down. Is Braille input as well supported?
Yep, absolutely, yep. So when you first, the only thing to be aware of is when you first type any key that isn't a command on your Braille display. So let's say you type a G. The first time you do that, Android will ask you for permission to change the keyboard to a Braille keyboard. And once you, because Android is very permission based, so it'll ask you, you know, can you change it? And you'll have to do that on the phone screen. Once you've done that, you can do everything, including waking up the phone from being locked with the Braille display. So once you've changed that keyboard once, off you go. And if you want to change it back, so for example, if you've not got your Braille display connected because you're just out with your phone, you just do a 3-finger swipe left or right, and that will change it back to the regular Gboard keyboard.
Why do you think it's important then that we as blind people can access our smartphones using refreshable Braille displays?
I think two things. One is spelling. Spelling is important to me, and sometimes speech will pronounce something correctly even if it's spelt wrong. And you can also find out the spelling of people's names and all that kind of stuff. But the other thing is, so that's output. So, you know, if you can actually feel rather than, because my philosophy has always been in the Braille is active and listening is passive. What that is, what I mean by that is Braille is reading and listening is listening, you know. It's important to me to have Braille output so that I can read what's on my phone. But Braille input as well is much, much faster than any touchscreen if you're a good Braillist, wouldn't you say, Dave? I would certainly agree with.
Well, it can depend on the system, yeah, and it depends on how accurate that back translation is as well. You're right about, you know, it does reinforce literacy skills, and of course for somebody who is deafblind it might be the only option, and sometimes it's nice just to free your ears to hear the people, the environment around you, and then being able to read in Braille. So how accurate do you find the Braille is on Android?
This is where we get a bit of a problem, because I don't know iOS Braille. I'm not familiar with it, but I'm sure iOS doesn't have these silly bugs, or you're going to tell me it does in a minute. But there is one silliness in Android, which I'm trying to get fixed at the moment, but I'm trying to get to the right people. That is, if you make a mistake, so let's say you're typing, just to be simple, if you're typing the word cat and you've got it in UEB, yeah? So you type DAT instead of CAT, right? Just for the sake of argument. You delete the D and you add the C. What you then get is CANAT.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you
see
why?
Yeah, okay.
Because it's contracted before you've completed the word.
Mm.
So that's a silly bug in Android where they could easily wait until you've got a space or move the cursor to a space before they translate.
And I suppose that's the difference between using, you know, Braille with a mainstream platform versus Braille on a Braille note taker, right? Where, you know, it's on a note taker, it's really been designed from the ground up, whereas Braille on a smartphone, I guess it's kind of been retrofitted. And some of these issues then crop up.
Yeah, but there is a nice thing, certainly with the Varios. I don't know if you can do it with other Braille displays. There's a nice thing you can do where, because the Vario has got a switch on it, hasn't it, Dave? You probably know that goes between note taker and Braille mode.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just flick a hardware switch and you're in your Braille note taker, your internal note taker. You flick that switch back and you're immediately connected back to your phone. So what you can do is you can type a document into your internal note taker, and it doesn't matter how long the document is, up to 10,000 characters. And then what you can do is you can flick the switch back, and with a single command, you can paste it into your phone app.
Yeah, that might be a better way to do it. Mm.
Yeah, you're doing all your translation on the internal note taker.
Yes.
And then once you flick it back and then use this command, you're pasting it literally into the edit text of your document that you've got open on your phone. And that applies to Android and iOS as well.
Now, talk to us, Steve, if you would, about this HID thing, because this is what kind of prompted the conversation initially about the fact that Android is getting this HID support, HID human interface device. It's supposed to make the process of connecting peripherals, in this case Braille displays, more seamless. That's coming in Android 15. Just talk us through that.
If I remember correctly, I think Humanware have really gone it all in with HID, HID. So if you don't have HID, I think, with Humanware, you can't connect over USB. And as you say, that HID allows the device to recognize the Braille display, what display it is, and it sets up all the parameters for that display, so you don't have to set it yourself in the settings and so on, and it connects instantly over USB or Bluetooth. You can connect, as I said, to a Humanware device over USB, but you can't connect currently over Bluetooth. So this HID will be a game changer for Android. iOS has had it for years. I don't know why it's taken Android so long to have it, but iOS has had that for years. And that's where iOS is better than Android in Braille currently. It does have HID. It just recognizes your display, connects to it, off you go. So HID is coming out in Android 15. It already is present in the betas, so you can test it if you're a beta tester of Android. I haven't personally tested it yet, but you can. And the only reason I haven't is because my Pixel is my main phone, and beta 15 has broken Google Pay, so you can't use Google Pay. And because it's my main phone, I can't update it to 15 yet. I will probably get hold of a cheap Pixel or something to test one day if I do beta testing and stuff like that. But, you know, once HID is introduced, then any Braille display should be fair game, provided that manufacturer supports HID. But, as I say, it isn't true that you can't use Braille displays over Bluetooth. It's just that you can't use certain ones over Bluetooth.
Right. And have you got any other tips, things that potential Android Braille users need to be aware of?
My use of Braille is, it's very stable on Android. I haven't had crashes or anything like that. The command structure is very similar, so they've been very similar. So a .123 chord will take you to the top of an edit box, and .456 chord at the bottom, you know. On Varios, because they've got essentially two space bars, they've got the left and the right, they've got B9 and B0, as they call it, Android uses both of those as a space bar, so you don't have to worry about whether it's the right or the left space on the various. But on other displays, it should work just as well. And I can't really say enough about it. And what it does is pretty stable. It's only the tables don't seem to have errors. The UEB tables don't seem to have errors that I've noticed. It's only that problem where it contracts prematurely when you're trying to make a correction. But, you know, if they fix that, then I think Braille will be pretty good on Android.
Anyone interested in getting started with Braille on Android, what's the best place to look for more information about that?
I guess androidaccess.com has some information about Braille. But there aren't many places that document about Braille. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone wants to email me at steve@comproom.co.uk. I'm happy to answer any questions about Android Braille because, you know, the more people that use it, hopefully the more we'll get fixed and Android Braille will be as good as iOS Braille.
Okay, and if anybody wants to know more about Computer Room services and the products and services that you offer, Steve, that website, just one more time.
It is www.comproom.co.uk.
Steve Nutt from Computer Room Services, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure a lot of you have been in various situations where you are, for example, travelling or you are out and you see that phone or that important device you are using is only on 5% battery and you are desperately needing to charge it. What do you do if you can't find a charging port or a charging socket? You find a power bank. I've got a few power banks in front of me and I want to talk you through some of them and just tell you some of the features that you can find in power banks to help at least simplify your choices. The first thing we'll talk about is your standard power bank. Now, what a standard power bank often looks like is a simple brick-shaped object. So the one I've got in front of me is a flat rectangular brick. If you imagine a very big smartphone, this is sort of what the shape of this power bank is. It's got three USB ports that I can plug in cables to charge any device. On the side, it has a button to turn it on. And on the other side, it has a port where you can plug in the cable to charge it. And on the front panel of the power bank, which is long and rectangular and flat, it's got few LED indicator lights, with the LED above the ports being a flashlight, I imagine, but I've never actually used it. The next kind of level of power banks which you can get is ones that have a wireless charging pad on top. So I've got one in front of me here. It's smaller than the other one. It's still a rectangular shape, but it is smaller. Still probably a size of an iPhone XR, I'd say, if you've ever seen that. So a fairly largish smartphone. It's got two USB ports, two micro USB ports in between them. On one side of it, it has a few indicator LED lights. On the other, it has a button to turn it on. On top of the power bank, it is flat, but there's a rubber circle in the middle, and it's not a filled-in circle, so it's a rubber ring kind of shape, and that indicates your wireless charging pad. So as the name suggests, this can charge your phone wirelessly if it supports it. A lot of smartphones these days do. In addition to plugging a simple cable into the power bank to charge your phone, you can also just lay your phone flat on the power bank and line it up. So if you have a smartphone, it's making sure that when you place it on the power bank, it is exactly with the edges of the power bank to make sure. So it's fairly easy to line up in a tactile fashion. And what I found with these, with some power banks, it's tricky to line the phones up. And sometimes it can easily disconnect because it's at an odd angle from the charging pad. The good thing about this one is as long as you lay your phone flat against the power bank, you most likely line it up correctly. The tricky part, obviously, with this one is you either need to then pick up the power bank with your phone on it to make sure it doesn't fall off and use your phone that way, or try to use your phone while it's lying on the power bank on top of the desk. So tricky to use the phone while it's charging on these, because they certainly don't recommend you taking it off the wireless pad, check your notifications and put it back on every time. That can cause significant damage. So if you are charging it wirelessly, keep it on there for as long as you want, until you get your desired charge, but definitely don't take it on and off the wireless charging pad. The next power bank is a bit different. This is where we combine the two again, so cables and a wireless charging pad, but with a bit of a twist. So the power bank I've got in front of me is by a company called DAJS, and it's an ultra slim fast charging power bank. Again, it is very similar to the one we've just talked about. It has two USB ports, another port in the middle, which I believe is micro USB or USB-C, and it's got a wireless charging pad. Physically, it's smaller than the last rectangular power bank. You can still line up a good smartphone on it. It's still probably a size of a smartphone, but it's gone down in size a bit. The wireless charging pad here is indicated a bit differently, in a sense that it's got a raised circle in the middle of the rectangular surface. But the other part is, you can plug in cables to the two USB ports and charge your device that way. Now, the good thing about this power bank, and actually the reason why I purchased it, is it's a great solution for someone who doesn't actually want to carry around additional cables, but still prefers to charge your devices via a cable. How does that work? So on the back of the power bank, on the surface opposite the charging pad, basically, there are four slots. And into each of these slots is folded in a cable. So you've got four cables that can be pulled back from the power bank that can charge different devices. So you've got a lightning cable, you've got a USB-C cable, you've got a micro USB cable. There is a fourth cable, and I can't actually identify what that one is because I've never had a cable of this kind. This power bank has cables built into it, so if you put your fingernail underneath the cable, you can actually pull it away from the power bank, and it's now hanging off the power bank, but it's a very short cable, so it's not actually in the way. And you can actually plug this cable into the back of an appropriate device, depending which cable you pull back. And once that device is finished charging, you can fold the cable back into the power bank and click it into the slot. The next one I'm going to show you does require cables still, but the big selling point is its portability. It's a Duracell power bank. The size of this power bank is a lot smaller than the others. If you kind of picture a box of Tic Tacs, but one of these huge boxes, one of these big boxes of Tic Tacs, if you've ever had them, that is probably the closest I can compare this to, but it's instead of having sharp edges, it's got rounded edges. That's the closest you're going to get a description wise from me. But the good thing is I can literally fit it in the palm of my hand. It is fairly small. So the good thing is you can put it in your pocket and it won't actually take up much space. So it has a USB port and a USB-C port, and you can plug the cable into that, then into your device. And there's a small button to press, which will turn it on. And next to that button, there are small LED lights. If you can see them, it will then tell you how much charge the power bank has. But the good thing is it's small and it's in the shape of these huge old school rectangular batteries as well. That's another object you can compare it to, but probably a little bit bigger than that. But still, very portable, quite good if you want a power bank that doesn't take up much space. So that's quite small and definitely recommended if you want a small power bank but want a wired connection. Next, I have a docking external battery pack from a company called iWalk, spelled I-W-A-L-K. So when as the Duracell power bank was a size of one of these old school rectangular batteries, this power bank is much smaller than that. It's still bigger than your kind of standard AAA battery. It's probably similar style shape, but much thicker, but still tiny. This battery plugs into the bottom of your phone like any other power bank, plugs into the charging port in your phone. Now, the difference with this power bank is it's a battery dock, I'd call it. And by dock, I mean it plugs into the bottom of your phone, but it's not an actual cable that plugs in, because this battery has a connector sticking out off the top of it, and it's got a little plastic cover they can put over the connector when you're not using it to protect it. And simply, you plug into the bottom of your phone, and the battery sticks out of the bottom of your phone. It doesn't really cause an obstruction, so you can still use your phone fairly securely because this battery will not fall out, neither will it be in the way of your hand. And I really like this one because I can just chuck it into my pocket, take it out, put it to the bottom of my phone and use it. I have no worries about cables sticking out and going everywhere. It is an excellent solution. So if you want this one, This one I highly recommend. You do have to probably recharge it quite frequently. I tend to recharge it every time I use it because I tend to basically squeeze the entire charge out of it to charge my phone. But it also depends. Sometimes when I'm traveling on the train and my phone is 5% and I've got two stops to go, I'll put it on charge and then take it out when I get home. So the phone is charged about 30% and there's still plenty of charge left in it, but I might still put it on charge just to make sure it's full so that when I need it, I don't need to worry about that dying as well. If you have any more questions and want any more advice or find something that you'd like us to take a look at, well, let us know. It's that email, techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Hubert Pavalkovic there with a collection of power banks. I think it's also important to mention that RNIB has an accessible power bank from Enegrid, £85, I think available in a couple of sizes. And this device provides audible and haptic feedback for letting you know how much power is remaining in the power bank. Callum Stoneman, do you use power banks very much?
Not really, although I am on the lookout for one because we've been getting things sorted for the hospital bag for when my wife goes into labour anytime, well, in the next couple of months. And one of the things that's on the many lists that we've been looking up for useful things to pack is a power bank, because you can't, not all hospitals will let you plug into their power supplies and you don't really know how long you're going to be there for. So you want to keep those devices charged up. And it's come at a good time, actually, because, I mean, you type, it's a bit like what I was saying last week about the smart home stuff, type power bank into Amazon, for example, you know, thousands of results come up from all kinds of brands and all different functionalities. You know, some of them have wireless charging, which sounds interesting, but I like the sound of these accessible ones. I mean, there's nothing worse, is there, than grabbing your power bank. You got to plug something in when you're on 10% or whatever, and then, oh, power bank's dead. Oh, great.
Hubert, tell us, why do you think a power bank's... I mean, if you tried these cases, some of the phone manufacturers and third parties have kind of battery cases. Are you more... You think the power bank's a bit more versatile?
I think what I find with the phone cases, because I quite liked them when I first discovered them, but what I find the problem with them is they add a lot of bulk to your phone. But the big advantage is you don't need to carry technically another unit, as in a power bank in your bag and the phone. You can just have one on top of the other. So there is that advantage, which is quite good. But I do find they make your phone incredibly bulky. Whereas, for example, you can plug in a small docking battery that I demonstrated in the piece, and it doesn't really cause much obstruction, and it just hangs off the bottom of your phone and it's quite small. So it doesn't really add much extra bulk to it. So yeah, I think there's advantages to all. It just depends, really, as I said, what you prefer and what works for each individual person, because there's so many different types of power banks in different shapes and sizes and formats. It's quite hard to choose, so it's good to know what some of the things that are available.
I think personally I would just go for, of course it depends what you want to do with them, but I would just go for one with a couple of USB ports, to be honest, or a couple of wireless charging, you know, pads, if you've got devices that support that. At least then you can charge basically anything. If you go down that route, you can use them for, within reason, whatever you want, you know.
There you are. Well, if you would like to check out the accessible power banks from the RNIB shop, just go on over to rnib.org.uk/shop and search for power bank, and you'll find the Enegrid power bank available with 10,000 or 20,000 milliamp hours. We are done. That's it for another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. Let us know if you have a comment, a question, a correction. You can get in contact in the usual way via email, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We, of course, will be back next week. But from myself, Dave Williams, Callum Stoneman and Hubert Pavalkovic, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
See you next week.
Bye.